From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, we remember actor and writer Charles Grodin, known for his deadpan comic performances in film and numerous deadpan and awkward TV appearances with Johnny Carson and David Letterman. His films include The Heartbreak Kid and Midnight Run. In his first film, he played a gynecologist in Rosemary's Baby and challenged director Roman Polanski on a take.
You could see he was trying to figure out whether he hated my guts or admired me.
We'll hear that story. Also, we remember influential record collector, producer, and store owner Bob Kester, who founded the blues and jazz label Delmark Records. And Justin Chang reviews The Killing of Two Lovers, and I'll review two new sci-fi TV series. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, sitting in for Terry Gross. Actor and comedian Charles Grodin, who made his mark in the movies and on TV, died Tuesday. He was 86 years old. Grodin's specialty was deadpan humor, the slow double take, the droll delivery, the ability to embody and embrace the most unlikable of characters, yet somehow make them very likable and very funny. On film, he constantly irritated Robert De Niro's character in the classic comedy Midnight Run. He had featured roles in Heaven Can Wait and Rosemary's Baby, and his big break came as the star of The Heartbreak Kid, written by Elaine May. In that film, he plays Lenny, a young man with spectacularly bad timing. On his honeymoon, he meets and falls in love with another woman, played by Sybil Shepherd. In this scene, he visits her parents and is at the dinner table trying to impress them.
Well, I don't mind saying that this is one of the finest meals that I've ever had.
Oh, thank you, Leonard. It's simple, you know. Mr. Corcoran doesn't really care for fancy food. Though I imagine you've tried just about every kind of exotic dish in New York.
Exactly. See, that's the trouble. It's exotic, but it's not honest. I mean, it's fancy, but it's not real. I mean, this is honest food. There's no lying in that beef. There's no insincerity in those potatoes. There's no deceit in the cauliflower. This is a totally honest meal. You don't know what a pleasure it is to sit down this day and age and eat food that you can believe in.
Oh, what an original way of putting it.
Charles Grodin appeared often on television, many years before Larry David portrayed an exaggeratedly abrasive version of himself on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Charles Grodin pulled a similar stunt almost any time he showed up on TV. He hosted Saturday Night Live in 1977 and spent the show pretending not to comprehend that the show was being broadcast live. That same year, he won an Emmy for writing the Paul Simon special, in which he also appeared on camera, playing that show's unbelievably obnoxious producer. And Grodin spent several decades visiting Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show, almost always showing up with nothing to plug or being unwilling to plug it.
No, I'm more interested in knowing what you really are. Are you interested in anything at all?
Absolutely. That's
seriously.
What I'm asking,
no,
yes.
No, you're not. No, really.
Of course I am.
You really care?
Yes.
What do you care about? I mean, in life. You care about anything? I mean, we hope the show goes on forever.
Sure.
All right. We hope everybody's happy. But, you know, given that and we're all healthy and happy,
right.
Is there anything in the world that
yes.
you actually
yes.
care about?
Yes.
What?
My health. And I have this terrible pain right now.
Terry Gross spoke to Charles Grodin in 1989. She asked him about his early career when he was often cast in TV westerns as the villain.
Were you good at being menacing?
Well, you know, after this was in 1966, 67. By that time, I had so much rejection in show business, I was very good at being menacing. the one thing that all the young actors could do was play rage and menace, because that's what they felt. We were so shut out all the time that you could only say when they didn't want you, thank you very much. You could never really express all this frustration. So a lot of us were good villains.
Have you ever heard? Overheard conversations about your looks in terms of whether you would have made it as a good leading man?
You know, I try to get into these rooms where they're having these meetings so I can overhear what they're saying, but they usually catch me. You know, like even today, if I'm out in Hollywood, I try to get around the back door of a studio to see if I can overhear some conversations about my looks. But it's hard to get in there to overhear them.
Mm-hmm. My guest is actually...
What do you mean? Where would I go to overhear conversations about my look? Are they having them somewhere? You mean, would you put that a different way?
I see your point.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever overheard anything about how much money you have? No, I've never overheard anything about that. Have you ever overheard anything about your weight? Yes, I did overhear the other day my wife and my daughter were talking about, is he fat or what? No, he's not, just the way he's standing. I overheard that.
Well, I figure there's some things casting directors discuss in front of you and some that they don't. but things that you find out anyways, whether they discuss it in front of you or not.
People have to be discussing,
well, I don't know, is he handsome enough for this
there
role?
There was a, yeah, they discuss everything. And, you know, one of the blessings is that you don't hear all the things that they're saying. I mean, I have an agreement with the people that represent me, is I really only hear if they want me. I mean, they definitely know not to call me every day and tell me all the things that they don't want me for. You know,
right.
That movie with Paul Newman, that one with Clint Eastwood, that one with Ryan O'Neal and Robert Redford? They don't want you for that. Thanks for being in touch. Thanks. And there's one coming up they want Jack Nicholson for. They don't want you for that. Oh, good. Good. Like, good to know that. You know. And Michael Keaton, that Batman thing, they wanted him. They didn't want you. Oh, really? Yeah, I kind of assumed it when I saw the movie because we hadn't heard anything about it. Yeah, well, they definitely didn't want you. They didn't want you for the Nicholson part in that either. Right. Okay, good. Well, thanks. I like to hear all this. No, I don't. I really try to not to think about it. That's why I think I spend so much time thinking about sports.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm afraid of what I might think about.
Well, how did you get from being like the bad guy and auditioning for action series to specializing in comedy, which it seems is what you've done over the past few years?
Well, I was really trained as a serious actor, and Elaine May, really, with The Heartbreak Kid, knew me socially, and it just was intending to star me in whatever movie she was going to direct. She just felt that she had this guy, that she was going around telling everybody how good I was, and everybody said, if he's that good, why don't we see him? And he says, well, when he has a chance, you will see it. But show business is so much about opportunity that, you know, as I've said, that if Dustin Hoffman hadn't been The Graduate, nobody would know what he was doing, because he was about heading out of the acting profession around that time. He was really, he had actually done some off-Broadway shows, but just before that, he had about given it up. And I really lost interest in it, too, right around 1965. It just was too difficult. You could be in a success and not get anywhere. But I was really put into The Heartbreak Kid as a comedy player and then totally perceived that way. Before that, it was just, you know, whatever you could do. I never wanted to be in a sitcom. I just didn't like that kind of rhythm playing. I was doing something different, and I wouldn't have fit in. So that's an extremely murky answer to your question.
Well, explain what it is that you feel like you do different from, for instance, the acting in a sitcom.
Well, sitcom is based a lot on rhythm. There's a setup and there's a punchline, a setup and a punchline, and I don't really do that. I just basically try to be alive in a situation, and I'm not really wanting to do jokes. Most of the humor that comes out of me has nothing to do with a funny line. It has to do with just being there. So I'm not, somebody said to me once, do you practice these looks in front of a mirror? I don't even know what I'm doing. I just know that I'm alive there in the situation. And that's what, if you ever, when you saw Candid Camera, these people weren't actors, but they were alive in a situation, and they're normal, honest responses were funny. And that's basically what I'm doing. I've really been trained to be able to be as though I were in life on the screen. And that's what I'm basically doing, just existing there, and then whatever's going to come out of me. Now, you know, if somebody like who is not maybe a humorous person in life did that, it wouldn't necessarily come out funny. But if you took a person who was humorous in life and they could do that, it probably would come out.
So you're trained in the method. You studied with Uta Hagen and with Lee Strasberg. Do you feel like you use the method in doing comedy roles?
Well, and to the extent that basically what it is that I function as an actor the way I'm functioning right now. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm responding personally to you. That's basically at the heart of it. It's a personal response. Now, the difference is, I'm making up. I mean, these are not written lines that I'm saying to you now. Well, most everything I say is written. I actually wrote down all these things in hopes you'd ask some of these questions. That's the difference. And then the skill is to be able to take the lines of the script and make it your own and make it come out of you naturally. But it's so you do apply it all the time.
When you were making Midnight Run with Robert De Niro, can you compare how you each prepared for your roles?
Well, in terms of the background of the part, Bob does a lot. He would like to live the life of the character. He actually went on drug bust with a bulletproof vest because his character did this kind of thing. Even though he didn't do it in the movie, this was part of being the character of Jack Walsh, who he played. I don't really do that. My focus is much more on what's going on right there at the moment. I just accept the fact that I'm an accountant who embezzled money from the mob and gave it to charity. I just accept that, and then I'm there with this guy. I just accept the situation, but I don't really go around embezzling money from the mob in preparation for the role.
So what kinds of differences does that make for when you're actually doing a scene together?
None whatsoever, because what he does is it just brings him to the point where he can be alive in the moment, and what I do brings me to the same point, that we're both doing the same thing. If there's one thing unique about us working together that I found different than a lot of other situations, that I believe in something I learned from Paul Muni in a book that Paul Muni wrote years ago, that you should, if you have a scene and say it's 3 pages long, for example, mm-hmm. you could learn those lines, but there's learning the lines and there's learning the lines. And I believe in learning the thing, so you could do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You could say, just as tools, that you could say these words so fast. So I believe in going over the thing and running it, just as the words, not how you're going to do it, not the interpretation, not the meaning, nothing like that. Just the tools, the words themselves. I would do that an unending amount of time to get it so solid with me that I know it just as quickly as I know the alphabet or counting to 10 or my own name. And Bob agrees with that. So we would sit there and maybe do that 100 times, which is a lot. I mean, it takes a very long time to run a 3-page scene 100 times. But there would be no limit, because he understood that once you do that and you go in front of the cameras, you're completely free to come alive and do anything. You're never thinking about your words. And too many actors, they think they've done the work, but they haven't done it. And it affects their work. And I've seen friends of mine, they say, what do you think? And I say, I don't think you know the lines well enough. And they say, no, I know them. I knew them at home. This is different, though. There's cameras. There's 50 people around. The distractions are tremendous. You've got to be so solid before you can really be free and be creative. And that's something I think he understands, and it's what I do, and it had a lot to do with the freedom you see in the playing.
Charles Grodin speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Actor and author Charles Grodin died Tuesday at age 86. He was famous for his deadpan delivery and delighted in playing abrasive characters in scenes that were full of awkward moments and silences. He won an Emmy for writing such scenes for the Paul Simon special in 1977, where he played a TV producer who gave the show's star some very unwanted and uncomfortable words of advice.
Now,
okay.
There is something I'd like to say to you, and it's been on my mind, and I think that I know you long enough that you're going to take it in the way I mean it, and I just like you to put it in the back of your mind, think about it when there is time to think about it.
Okay, shoot.
The sound of you and Artie singing together is so much better than either of you singing alone that whatever petty differences you might have had in the past, I strongly urge that you take a long, hard look at them. Just think about it.
Terry Gross spoke to Charles Grodin in 1989.
You played the gynecologist, the first gynecologist in Rosemary's Baby, which was directed by Roman Polanski. And you tell a really funny and also very interesting story in your book about a pause that you wanted to put in a line. Would you tell that story and
yes.
explain the significance of the pause
yes.
to you?
Mia Farrow comes to me for help and says that she feels that these witches and demons, whatever it is, are pursuing her. And at the end of this long tale, which sounds insane to me as a doctor, I'm supposed to say, you may be right, and then I'm supposed to make some phone calls to help her. Well, I thought if she told me that whole story and I said, you may be right, the audience would say, like, well, why? It's very unlikely. He'd just believe that. So when she finished the story, I looked at her for a long time as though I was considering what she'd said, and I very slowly said, well, you know, you may be right. And then Roman Polanski, the director, leaped up and says, take out that pause. And I explained my point, that which I just made here. And he says, no, it's not more believable if you have a pause. It's less believable. So I really didn't agree with him. It was my first picture, and he was a famous director at the time, and I kind of did it with less of a pause. At the end of the day, I went up to him, and I said, you know, Roman, I was thinking about what you said, what you told me this afternoon, and you know something? And then I took the longest pause you can imagine, and I said, I think you're right. He says, good, that's right, that's what I'm saying. I said, did you just believe me? He says, yes. I said, but I'm lying. That's what I wanted to do in the scene. And he looked at me, and you could see he was trying to figure out whether he hated my guts or admired me. And he decided he admired me, and he threw his arm around my shoulders. Come with me, watch the film from the previous day. And we go in, and the next day, after he had time to sleep on it, he realized that he hated my guts after all. And for the rest of the movie, I said, Roman, he said, I don't care what you do. No matter what I would want to ask.
Well, this must be a constant source of anguish for an actor deciding whether you should go with your own intuition on how to play something or go with the director's advice.
It doesn't really come up for me. My relationship with directors that I work with, and it's been true for several years, is I like them to see what I'd like to do. If they don't like it, that's fine. But I don't really have that was a unique problem. Generally speaking, I can't really think offhand of anyone asking me to do something that I thought was inappropriate. There was a play I was in once where they wanted me to, when the woman opened the door, they wanted me to fall into the room as though I was leaning against the door. And I said, gee, I really would rather not do that. And the director said, I know that's going to get a laugh. I said, well, I know it's going to get a laugh from some people in the audience too, but it's going to really take away the credibility that this is an actual person. It will look like an actor doing a bit. And he took my point, and I didn't do it. I mean, when people say they got a laugh, and you hear performers say this sometimes, they count it a laugh if somebody laughs. But if you have 800 people in an audience and three people laugh, I consider like 797 people were just bored by what you did. That's not a laugh. So the demands that I put on what's a laugh are different. But generally, my understanding with directors now is I will have things to say. I like to try this and do this and whatever. And you be in charge, and you choose, and you make the judgment. And all I want you to do is to see it, and it works very well that way. Everybody, as long as it's very clear that they're in charge, the director is comfortable, and I'm comfortable because he has to be in charge. I don't want to try to be in charge. If I'm in charge, then I'll be in charge. But essentially, it's the director who's in charge.
There have been times when you were unable to stop yourself from laughing. You tell the story in your book of when you were playing with Ted Knight, who played Ted Baxter, the newsman on the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
in a
soap opera, an afternoon soap opera, and you had a lot of scenes together, and every time you'd be on the set together, you would just break up. Was that because of the knowledge of the absurdity of the whole program?
Well, we were very
doing?
Good friends off screen, and we really had a lot of laughs off screen, but the real problem was that we were playing, as you do in many soap operas, a variation on one scene, and the scene was that he was my boss, and I would constantly come in and ask him if Irene Forsythe, who was my mother-in-law in the show, the character's name was Irene Forsythe, if she had anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries, which of course she did, you know. And this scene, we must have played this scene, I don't know what, a dozen times over a period of time. So when I'd come in and I'd say, you know, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? Did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job here at Forsythe Industries? Now, Matt, we've discussed this before. And, you know, and we had discussed it many times. And Ted kind of used like an English accent on the show. Oh, Matt, I don't think this is anything we should be discussing. And we couldn't do it. We just couldn't do it. I mean, here we, you know, like 2 weeks later, Ted, can I have a word with you? Yes, Matt, what is it? I just was thinking this afternoon, and I was wondering if, did Irene Forsythe have anything to do with me getting my job on Forsythe? Now, Matt, we couldn't do it. We just like look at us, oh, please don't ask me this question again. Yes, she got your job. You stink. You couldn't get a job on your own. All right, leave me alone. You know, but we never said that. We just kind of like made it another scene. But the hardest time I ever had in a movie is something I didn't write about in the book, but you could almost see it in the movie of The Heartbreak Kid when I have a showdown scene with Eddie Albert. And he tries to buy me away from marrying Sybil Shepherd, and I somehow get into a speech about how I was in the service and during the war, and that I, to show what a tough guy I am, I say, you know, when I was in the armed forces of our country, and I fought every moment for 3 years, and I fought every moment of those 3 years, and the line in the script was, not overseas, unfortunately, because of a minor back condition. And I couldn't get through that scene because I was so, you know, I fought for our country for 3 years. Not overseas, unfortunately, because, and I couldn't get through it. And even now, if you look at the movie, you'll see, like, at that moment, I'm, like, staring at the floor, like, biting my tooth off. You know?
Look, Mr. Corcoran, I didn't come out here to negotiate for Kelly. I came out here to fight for her. I spent 3 years in the United States Army. I fought every damn minute of those 3 years. Unfortunately, not overseas because of a minor back injury. But in the small army towns of this country...
You say that sometimes you tell a joke with such a straight face that people take you seriously. Has that gotten you into any trouble recently?
I think it's always gotten me into trouble. It's something I've tried to rectify. I don't know. I mean, I make an assumption about things sometimes that what I'm saying is so absurd it couldn't possibly be taken seriously. But, you know, people read expression more than they do content. And I've learned that, and I really don't like that. I mean, I really don't like to mislead people or to fool people or anything like that. I mean, and it's happened many times. In fact, you know, many people, you know, have been uncomfortable. I remember Warren Beatty, who's a pretty smart guy, saying to me, I don't know what if you're kidding or not. Well, when he said it to me, it really struck me because he's very quick. He's a very hip guy, and if he couldn't tell, then, you know, what am I trying to do? I'm not trying to put something over on people. I'm trying to amuse people. If they really don't know what I'm doing, then I have to do something differently. And I have in recent years attempted to not have that happen.
Charles Grodin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Terry.
For talking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Grodin, speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. The actor and author died Tuesday at age 86. After a break, we remember record store owner and producer Bob Kester, who died last week at age 88. Also, film critic Justin Chang reviews The Killing of Two Lovers, and I review two new sci-fi TV series, Solos and The Bite. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine and More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at totalwine.com. And from Indeed with Instant Match, connecting businesses with candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job description the moment they sponsor a job. Learn more at Indeed.com/credit.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our film critic, Justin Chang, says the gripping marital drama The Killing of Two Lovers was one of the best movies he saw more than a year ago at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. It's finally available to watch now and can be found on major streaming platforms. Here is his review.
Just about every era gets the great end of a marriage movie it deserves. Sometimes even more than one. The 70s gave us Scenes from a Marriage and Kramer vs. Kramer. The past decade brought us the Iranian masterpiece A Separation, and more recently, the justly acclaimed Marriage Story. While it doesn't much resemble any of them, The Killing of Two Lovers belongs in their company. It's a tense, stripped-down, superbly acted drama about a family at a perilous moment of transition. While the movie is never as brutal as its title might suggest, the threat of brutality seems to loom over every frame. Clayne Crawford and Sepide Mouafi play David and Nikki, a small-town Utah couple who have recently agreed to a trial separation. David has moved in with his dad just down the road, close enough to drop in frequently on Nikki and their four kids. He's hoping for a reconciliation so that their family can get back together. But Nikki sees the marriage as pretty much over. She and David wed young, right out of high school, and after years of career setbacks, financial difficulties, and the many challenges of raising a large family, she's ready to move on. She's already moved on, in fact, with a boyfriend named Derek, played by Chris Coy. The terms of David and Nikki's separation allow them to see other people, but that's small consolation for David, the story's protagonist, who spends much of his time seething with fury. The movie begins with a scene in which you wonder if he really is going to kill the two lovers, whom he finds sleeping one morning in the bed that he used to share with his wife. Later, he quietly stalks Derek around town, armed with a pistol that he looks all too willing to use. In both situations, though, his better judgment prevails, and he backs down. David is capable of violence, as Clayne Crawford's tightly wound performance makes clear, but he also turns out to be more complicated than he appears. In fact, the entire situation is more complicated than it appears. At one point, David and Nikki have an agreed-upon date night, and it's clear from their tender, bittersweet conversation that they still love each other deeply. That doesn't mean the movie is necessarily rooting for their reunion. While the story isn't told from Nikki's point of view, Sepide Mohaffi's smart, empathetic performance ensures that we see her side of it. The breakup is, of course, hard on the kids, whom David adores and tries to spend as much time with as possible, especially his moody teenage daughter. In this scene, he tries to win over his three younger sons with some truly terrible dad jokes as he walks them to the school bus stop.
Hey, Alex.
Yeah?
What do you call a pile of kittens?
What?
A meowton.
Come on, Dad.
Meowton.
That is terrible.
What new joke?
New jokes? You guys tell me a joke.
The dog's always in a push-up position. Mitch Hedberg, search him up.
Mitch Hedberg, who's that?
Comedian that's actually good.
Oh, the bus is here.
Bye, boys!
The Killing of Two Lovers was written and directed by Robert Machoyan, a Utah photography professor who's been making films for more than a decade, sometimes with members of his own family. Here, his three boys play David's sons, and his own father plays David's father. Machoyan's style is intimate and psychologically raw. Sometimes he and his gifted cinematographer, Oscar Ignacio Jimenez, bring the camera so close that you can see David's every wrinkle and pore. Sometimes they pull back and position him against the flat Utah landscape, whose stark, wintry beauty seems to reflect his own desolation. The movie sounds even more arresting than it looks. Instead of a traditional score, it features a soundscape consisting of everyday noises, like the repeated slamming of a car door, that capture the tedium of David's routine. All this gives The Killing of Two Lovers an extraordinary level of moment-to-moment tension, even when it seems as though not much is going on. That's part of the movie's point. So much of the drama in our lives arises not from major events, but rather from the anguished anticipation of those major events. But while David spends a lot of his time brooding, the story never feels dull or repetitive. It's mesmerizing to watch him respond in real time to a fraught situation that he and his family have never been through before. I won't reveal what happens at the end of The Killing of Two Lovers, except to say that it's credible yet surprising, and likely to fill you with a strange mix of hope and alarm. Machoyan knows that when it comes to love and family, life is full of unexpected contradictions, and he's done a brilliant job of turning those contradictions into art.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we remember record store owner and producer Bob Kester, who died last week at age 88. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hint, maker of fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Available in more than 25 flavors, including watermelon and pineapple. In stores or delivered from drinkhint.com. And from the University at Buffalo, where UB bioengineers are using microtissues to find new drug treatments for life-threatening lung diseases. Learn more at buffalo.edu/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember the influential record store owner and producer Bob Kester, who founded Delmark Records. He died last week at the age of 88. Terry interviewed him in 2003 when the label celebrated its 50th anniversary with the release of a double CD. It included this track by the first band recorded by Delmark, the Windy City Six. Back in 1952, driven by his passion for jazz and blues, and in need of a place to park his collection of 2,000 albums, 17-year-old Bob Kester opened the Jazz Record Mart in St. Louis. A year later, he started Delmark Records, which went on to release records by such blues and jazz artists as Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, Sleepy John Estes, Otis Rush, and Sun Ra. Kester said his record store was, for him, like an overgrown hobby. In 1958, he moved the Jazz Record Mart to Chicago, where it became a well-known gathering place for musicians, music lovers, and tourists. Over the years, Kester was a mentor and father figure for many Chicago musicians, and he was considered one of the major forces behind the blues revival in the mid-60s. He also captured early examples of avant-garde jazz. When they spoke in 2003, Terry asked about one of his earliest releases.
Now, why was Big Joe Williams willing to record for you, Bob Kester, who at the time was a very young, inexperienced producer with very little track record?
Well, whether he was on Delmark or BJ or trumpet, he was getting union scale. And the sad fact was his records weren't selling very well. I think he was intrigued with the idea of being on an LP.
Was this his first LP?
Oh, yeah.
He'd made 78s and 45s before that?
It came close to being the first LP of Mississippi Country Blues.
This is a great track. Why don't we hear this 1958 recording featuring Big Joe Williams doing Midnight Creep. Now, this is actually previously unreleased. I think it was recorded for that first LP that you were referring to, but it wasn't released as part of it. Why not?
We just never had the money. Joe is just a fountain. It's just like turning on a water tap. The music would come pouring out, and he would record an enormous amount of material at every session, and you just had to go through and pull out what you felt worked together as an album. You try to program an album, and I was trying to program an album toward ears that weren't yet geared to blues. You never needed second takes with Big Joe Williams.
Okay, well, here it is from 1958, Big Joe Williams, Midnight Creep.
Lord, I wonder where my baby gone is. Well, I wonder where my baby gone is. Since she left this morning, I haven't did nothing wrong. Well, I feel like walking, baby, talking all night. Well, I feel like walking, baby, talking. Well, the woman I'm loving, she sure don't treat me right. Well, I wonder why my baby done it home. Well, I wonder why my baby done it home. She been gone, left me, and I sure don't feel wrong. I got 19 women, Lord, I want one more.
That's Big Joe Williams recorded in 1958. That track is featured on the new Delmark Records 50th Anniversary Anthology. You know, if the guitar playing sounded a little unusual on that, it's because Big Joe Williams played a 9-string guitar. Tell us a little bit about that guitar.
Well, Joe got tired of people borrowing his guitar or just picking it up between sets and playing it, so he rigged up the 9-string. It was, I think, to some extent a gimmick. And he apparently had some kind of strange tuning that other people couldn't cope with. That had a lot to do. That's what he says was the reason. But, of course, he developed a rather unique sound eventually.
It sounds like a pretty weird reason to start playing a 9-string guitar.
Well, those guitars were usually his most valuable possession, and right. He didn't want people messing with it.
Some of the people who've worked in your record store have gone on to be, you know, record producers or recording artists. Mm-hmm. One of the people who worked in your record store, Bruce Iglauer, founded Alligator Records, which is a blues label in Chicago. And in an article about you, he was quoted as saying about you, he's terribly argumentative. He hardly says anything nice about anybody, but he's just as generous as hell. He almost fired me a couple of times, mostly for good reasons. And at the same time, he was extraordinarily nice to me. It's hard to explain. Bob will snarl at people. He used to break 78s over his employees' heads. So I want to hear about you breaking 78s over your employees' heads.
Oh, well, we always have 78s that are worthless. And 78s break pretty good, pretty well. I always made sure they weren't Columbias, because Columbias had paper lamination in them. They were made of a deadly weapon. Or Edison's, which are terrible. Well, Edison's are too valuable. I don't think I did that very often, and it was pretty much a jovial thing. And there were probably records that were cracked anyway. Happily, nobody got hurt.
Did you ever break a 78 over somebody's head and realize years later that it was actually a decent 78 and was worth a lot of money?
No, I always make sure it was something by Perry Como. Or something. Perry Como was on Victor. They're the most brittle, breakable records ever made in that period.
What did you grow up listening to, and how were you exposed to it?
Well, my grandfather had a collection of classical 78s. He died when I was very young, but when we moved into his house, the records were still there, and there was one by the original Dixieland Jazz Band and one by another group, the California Ramblers or something. That was probably the first jazz records I played, but I had polio in sixth grade, and I heard the Eddie Condon show, the Saturday afternoon jam session, and that had a lot to do with it. But that was when I was growing up. It was the tail end of this big band swing era. That's the only time when jazz was the popular music in this country, roughly 1935 to the middle 40s. So I got to hear a lot of Basie, and not a lot of Basie and Ellington. They didn't get that much airplay in those Jim Crow days. But I got to hear a lot of Woody Herman and Charlie Barnett and some of Basie. I was able to go see Basie at the Miller Theater. I guess that's the first live jazz I ever heard. And Jimmy Rushing still singing with him. That must have been 47 or 48, something like that.
Did music keep you company when you were stuck at home with polio?
Well, I wasn't. By the time I got out, I kept looking for good jazz when I was in the hospital. When I got home, I didn't want to be around the house. I wanted to get the heck out and around. And I was encouraged to ride bicycles and, you know, to put my legs back into shape.
Well, we should end with a jazz recording. I should ask you if you have a favorite from the 50th anniversary collection that you'd like to play.
The stuff I'm most proud of is the Roscoe Mitchell and the other AACM records, a part of the catalog that I think is our most important contribution to jazz. We did the first AACM record, the first Roscoe, the first Braxton, the first Mewall.
And AACM what's the acronym?
The Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians. This was a group of self-determinist avant-garde musicians in Chicago, and started in the early 60s, and gave birth to all these guys that I've mentioned and many, many more.
And it was the genesis of the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Right, yeah. I think that was the most important music happening anywhere in the world at that time. I mean, it had its counterparts in Kansas City, St. Louis, and New York, Boston, Philly, and so forth, and it later in Europe. But I think it's our most important contribution. But I have to say, I really enjoy the older stuff more.
So you
I'm
think...
very, very proud of our six albums with Art Hodes. He's the only really great musician from the 20s that we took in the studio, although we got a lot of good Earl Hines stuff, too.
So you're proudest of giving some of the Chicago avant-gardists their start, but your heart is really with Art Hodes, the Stride piano player.
Well, when I go to an avant-garde concert now, I can get into the music a lot better. But I like a drink now and then when I'm listening to music, and it's not really drinking man's music. It's thinking man's music.
Record store owner and producer Bob Kester, founder of Delmark Records, speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. He died last week at age 88. After a break, I review two new sci-fi TV shows, Solos and The Bite. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. When the pandemic shut down most TV and movie production last year, no one knew when filming could resume safely. A few resourceful TV writers and producers decided not to wait and to approach the COVID restrictions like a challenge. What kind of TV shows could you film during a pandemic, and how? Examples of that inventiveness show up this week on two different streaming services. Both shows are in the fantasy genre and come from respected TV writer-producers. Robert and Michelle King, creators of The Good Wife, have come up with The Bite, a present-day comedy drama that combines COVID lockdown with an outbreak of a zombie contagion. And David Weil, creator of Hunters, presents Solos, an anthology series set at various points in the future with technology playing a prominent part. Solos, presented by Amazon, has a different star in each episode. And for the most part, that's it. One way to film during a pandemic without having the actors risk exposure to COVID is to have only one actor on screen. Weil and the other writers employ various tricks to make the shows more than straight-out monologues, and the best of them work very well. Helen Mirren plays an astronaut alone in space, talking to her onboard computer like it's HAL from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Anthony Mackie plays two roles, a wealthy dying young man who meets and briefs his look-alike cybernetic replacement. And in the premiere episode, Anne Hathaway plays several roles, but they're all the same one at different times. She plays a scientist working on time travel and finds a way to communicate in the future, or the past, with herself. Eventually, she establishes a video link, but the first time she makes contact, it's by audio only, when her time-scanning machinery locks on to a familiar voice.
Tell me your name! Leia Salavara. And you're... I'm Leia. I'm Leia Salavara, too!
Oh, my God. But wait, how can I know that you're really...
You?
Yeah, I mean, with something that only I... only we would know.
First kiss, no tongue. Henry John.
First kiss with tongue.
Mallory Jackson.
Favorite singer. The real one, not the one that you tell people. Kelly Clarkson.
Just because she's popular doesn't mean she's not amazing.
The installments of solos I've mentioned are the best of the seven-episode bunch. Helen Mirren, as a 71-year-old space traveler looking back on her life, delivers a performance that shouldn't be missed and that I expect will haunt me for a long time. Solos is the closest thing the U.S. has come to the superb British sci-fi anthology series Black Mirror, and absolutely is worth checking out. So is The Bite, if you can find it. The Bite is the latest TV series from Robert and Michelle King, creators of The Good Wife and Evil on CBS, and The Good Fight on what now is Paramount Plus. The Bite is a 6-episode miniseries that solves its COVID production dilemma in two ways. First, it casts two real-life husband and wife couples in 4 primary roles so they can safely share the screen in respective 2 shots. And second, it sets the action in the present day during a pandemic quarantine. So characters largely are housebound, working and communicating via their computers. Audra McDonald, who eventually will share scenes with her real-life spouse Will Swenson, plays Rachel, a doctor living in Manhattan who's making house calls without leaving her house via Zoom. It's the same way she connects with her mother, a world-famous doctor, who appears on Rachel's computer screen with an entertaining amount of attitude, played by Leslie Uggams.
Hi, Mom. I'm here.
What is going on with your hair? Is this about Black Lives Matter?
Oh, my God. Will you please stop talking?
You're just guilty because you married a white man.
Okay. All right. Stop. Listen. Zach asked me to call you.
This is about that AP quote. I only said what was true.
But that's not why you're saying it.
Really? Educate me, dear. Why am I saying it?
Because you are upset that Zach did not include you in his advisory
committee. Not upset. Just surprised he decided not to include a Nobel Prize winner in immunology.
Mom, Zach told you he was worried about the appearance of nepotism.
The virus doesn't care about nepotism. It only cares about spreading and infecting.
The Bite is lots and lots of fun and has a lot going on. Stephen Pasquale and Philippa Sue, another real-life couple, play government healthcare experts. And Taylor Schilling from Orange is the New Black plays Rachel's upstairs neighbor, Lily, who's also working remotely from home during the pandemic. But it's trickier for her because she's a dominatrix. Before long, The Bite throws all these characters together as they try to avoid the zombie plague and find a cure. The action ranges from playful over-the-top silliness to moments of true tenderness, and Robert and Michelle King always have great fun playing with the latest technologies and our shared frustrations with them. So The Bite not only has plagues like COVID and a zombie virus, it also has such plagues as dropped wireless signals, frozen computer screens, and accidentally pressed mute buttons. Audra McDonald, as the main character, carries it all off effortlessly and impressively. If you saw the King's most recent summer series, the similarly bizarre CBS sci-fi show Braindead, you have a good idea what's coming. The Bite is great fun. Its only fault is that it's premiering not on CBS, not even on Paramount Plus, but on Spectrum On Demand. I'm hoping CBS will repurpose The Bite later this summer as a broadcast premiere, as it did with The Good Fight. After all, what else does it have to offer that's this fresh and this enjoyable? On Monday's show, we talk with Donnie Walton, whose debut novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev, has been described as a dazzling triumph. It's about an unlikely music duo from the early 1970s. Opal is a black feminist from Detroit who is Afropunk before that term existed. And Nev is a withdrawn, goofy, white British guitarist. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, Kayla Lattimore, and Joel Wolfram. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.B. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Penguin Random House, publisher of Amanda Gorman's The Hill We Climb, the poem read at the inauguration. Now available as a commemorative edition featuring a foreword by Oprah Winfrey. More at amandagormanbooks.com. And from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.